If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret. Searching for the sound. This is The Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman.
Snatch it back and hold it. Help myself. Somebody help me. somebody help me.
You've been listening to Snatch It Back and Hold It into Hold It Back, Back into Snatch It Back and Hold It. Yeah, that's a mouthful. A track originally recorded by Junior Wells, popularized by Buddy Guy and Steve Miller, and modernized by Government Mule with that Hold It Back segment off the band's forthcoming record, Heavy Load Blues, due out November 12th on Fantasy Records. For their next album, Government Mule have produced their first real blues record, Heavy Load Blues. It's a 13-track masterpiece with both Warren Haynes penned originals and a bunch of great cover songs, which Mule, of course, have transformed and turned into their own. While the record isn't out for another few weeks, I caught up with the frontman of Government Mule, the great Warren Haynes, to talk about the record, how it came to be, and what's next for the band. I should mention that for the most part, we stuck to discussing the new record just before Warren performed with Phil and Friends and was absolutely superb. Heavy Load Blues is being billed as your first blues record. What's interesting about that is I've always thought you guys were a blues band for the most part, and you've always been based in the blues and have always had tinges of the blues in your music dating back to day one. So it's interesting that this is being billed as a blues record.
Yeah, I think, blues is a huge part of everything we do and a huge part of everything I do for the most part. But this is the first time that myself or the band has approached something like with traditional parameters, anything that doesn't loosely fall within the parameters of blues would be not considered for this, and that starts with the way it was recorded and the way it sounds sonically and the song selection and everything.
So let's talk a bit about that, because this is the first record in a while that wasn't recorded at Willie Nelson's studio. This was recorded at the Power Station in New England. And from what I could read and gather, all live off the floor to analog tape. I mean, is that what you're talking about when you're saying you've gone back to the roots of this music?
Yeah. I mean, we always record pretty live as possible anyway. And we normally record onto analog tape. But for this record, I'll just go all the way back. We wanted to make two records at once. So I'm not sure if you're aware of that part of the story, but when we started talking about making a blues record, I thought, well, thanks to being locked down all this time, I have all these songs that I'm dying to record, and a handful of them are blues songs. But the majority of them are just songs, in some cases, Government Mule songs. So it was really important to make a regular Government Mule record as well. When we decided to make the blues record, we thought, well, we want it to sound completely different. We want it to sound like an old record. And so it became important to find a studio that had two separate rooms where we could set up one big room and one small room and two completely different sets of gear. And so these two rooms at Power Station adjoin each other, and they're separated by glass walls if you want to have them open or not. And the small room has low ceilings and the big room has high ceilings. So we set up like a normal Government Mule record in the big room. And in the little room, we put all these little amplifiers and a small keyboard setup and a small drum kit and no headphones, just played like we were in a little club. The vocal was coming through a monitor and also coming through an amp, through a little guitar amp. And so every mic was picking up every instrument. There was no way to separate anything. Everything's leaking into every microphone. So we were forced to live with the live performances, which is what we wanted to do anyway. So the plan was we would go into the big room early in the day and work on Government Mule stuff all day. And then sometime late at night, we'd go over into the little blues room and play blues for a few hours and then go home.
And so this is what we've had now. So how much, it doesn't sound like you spent a lot of time in the big room. It sounds like you mostly spent the majority of the recording of this record, at least, in the little room with just the four of you all huddled together.
Well, all of this record was done in the little room. We probably spent more time in the big room working on the main Mule record than we did working on the blues record, but it was an everyday process. You know, we go in at 1 o'clock and work till 8 or 9. And then we would take a break and then we'd go play blues and work till midnight, sometimes 1 a.m. And then go home and get up and do it the next day.
So what you're saying is there is another record coming. I mean, there is another more traditional Government Mule record coming.
Absolutely. And I think it's okay to talk about that. I've mentioned it in several interviews. And to me, it's kind of part of the story. You know, I think it's important to for people to know that we didn't spend 2 years thinking, oh, let's go cut a bunch of cover songs. I've written more in the past 2 years than I've written in 20 years.
Right. So let's talk a bit about the song selection on Heavy Load Blues then. It's funny because there are 13 tracks on the record, and by my count, 6.5 are originals and 6.5 are covers. And I say half of the bridge, because of the Hold It Back, the Hold It Back bridge in Snatch It Back and Hold It. How did you determine which were going to be the songs that you covered? And some of them have been, well, at least one you've played as a band before, the Ann Peoples song. You've played, I think, once before. And one song, and I could be totally wrong, but I think the Almonds played it. Ain't No Love in the Heart of the City. I think the Brothers played back a while ago as well. So there are a couple of covers that you guys are familiar with. But how did you determine the balance between originals and covers, and what covers were actually going to make it on this record?
Well, it was a work in progress. I've been making a list of blues songs that I wanted to cover for several years now. I wanted it to be all fresh material. I didn't want it to be songs that we cover on stage. We specifically made an exception for the song you mentioned, Feel Like Breaking Up Somebody's Home, because we feel like the version that we've worked up through the years is a really unique kind of version, and it was important to capture it if we could. You also brought up Ain't No Love in the Heart of the City. We did that a few times with the Allman Brothers, and sometimes Greg and I would share verses. And we did it one time with Greg and Boz Skaggs sharing verses. And Government Mule played it a couple of times in Europe when our friend Bertie Marsden would sit in, who was in the original version of Whitesnake that had a hit on that song.
That's right.
And one time we played it with Bernie and Don Airey, the keyboard player who took John Lord's place in Deep Purple. But other than that, and the other exception being If Heartaches Were Nickels, which is a song that I wrote that Joe Bonamassa recorded years ago, we played that a couple of times as well. Everything else we were playing for the first time. And that's kind of the way I wanted it to be. I wanted it to have the spirit of the old blues records, where you just come in and everything happens on the floor and you walk out with a record.
Well, I assume that that's certainly the case with Snatch It Back and Hold It. I mean, it's a Junior Wells popularized by Buddy Guy tune, and you can tell that you're all into it and that you all know the song real well. What's interesting to me is that connection piece, is that little bridge that's original that you guys, is that just a jam off the floor in between verses that you guys decided to keep going and break up the song a little bit? How did that come about?
I had been working on the little motifs in that song, thinking it might be a little instrumental piece. And there's just two or three little motifs. But then at the same time, it occurred to me that it would fit really good in the middle of Snatch It Back. So I decided instead of making it a whole song, let's just make it a little interlude, changes key, changes to halftime tempo-wise. And we just, you know, we worked up Snatch It Back and we worked up that little piece and we thought, okay, now let's combine them. There was very little rehearsal or thought given to it. And the take that we kept was the first take. And it just had that thing that felt good. So we're like, yeah, that's from here forward. I guess that's the way we're going to do it.
Yeah, it's great. Well, do you think that Hold It Back will appear by itself ever? You know, the way that Train sometimes appears by itself out of thin air. Like, is that a possibility, or will it always in a live performance show up in the middle of Snatch It Back and Hold It?
Well, I think I've actually thought about that. Maybe it will appear coming out or in the middle of other songs.
Oh, cool.
Not just Snatch It Back, but appear in Train as an example.
Yeah.
I don't know that we would ever start it and finish it on its own. Cause as of now, it has neither an intro or an ending.
Right.
but I do like the idea of it just appearing in odd places.
Cool. It's interesting that you mentioned Ain't No Love in the Heart of the City, popularized, and they did have a big hit with it with Whitesnake, but there's so many people that have recorded it. Black Pumas just recorded it, and Jay-Z samples it. I mean, is that the mark of a great tune, the amount of people that cover it and use it in their music, and that it connects with so many people?
It can be, for sure, and that is a great tune. I haven't heard the Black Pumas version, but I do like what I've heard of them.
Yeah.
And I was mostly familiar, obviously, growing up with the Bobby Blue Bland version, which is the version that we're kind of using as a template. It was also recently they took that little instrumental section and used it in a car commercial. So, you know, you'd be watching TV and hear bump, 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 with it. Not the song, just that part.
You know? Yeah.
And now I'm a Ram, the Al Green song that we've been covering for the past several years. There's a Chris Stapleton version of that in a commercial.
I contend that they ripped you off. I contend that Chris, that when I heard it, I thought, what do you mean I'm a Ram? Like that's Government Mule. How dare Chris Stapleton cover Government Mule covering Al Green?
Which, to be full disclosure, was us covering Big Sugar.
right.
Covering Al Green. That, you know, that's an interesting story, because the way we started doing I'm a Ram is when Mule and Big Sugar were on tour a long time ago, Woody and I would get up and play that song with them.
With Gordy, yeah.
And it was one of Woody's favorite tunes to play. And so after he died, I thought we should start playing that song. And when that came to fruition was when we were working with Gordy from Big Sugar in the studio. So I guess it's a full circle. I would feel less ripped off had we not borrowed it as well.
Yeah, fair. I just, when I first heard it, I'm like, oh, that's really cool. But wait a second. Yeah. That's not so cool. He's amazing, though. I mean, got to give full props to Chris Stapleton. He's an incredible musician, right? And his voice is just...
I love his voice, and I love what he's doing. He's shaking things up, man. And it's just good to see people, you know, refusing to be pigeonholed.
Yeah, agreed.
I love that.
Agreed. Let's keep talking about the record, because I really love it. Brother Bill, Last Clean Shirt. is so different from the Animals version. I mean, it's completely different. And in my estimation, maybe even a little bit cooler because you slow it down a little bit. And, you know, the Animals version to me is a pop song. And you guys go back to probably what Lieber and Stoller may have been thinking about originally is making that kind of a blues number with it.
Yeah, I think, you know, their version had that kind of novelty flair about it, which is cool because the lyric can lend itself that way, especially at that time period. I was shocked when I went back and heard it again. Oh, they're talking about cocaine in an old poppy sort of song. When I thought, well, if we slow it down and make it kind of nasty, that could be really cool. And to my knowledge, nobody's ever done it that way. If they have, it's unbeknownst to me.
And you cuss off the top, right? As part of the lyric. Yeah. So it's right. It's very different.
If they can say cocaine 50 years ago or whatever it
you
was,
can say fuck.
I can say motherfucker now.
Yeah. Heavy Load is just a masterful performance of you on an acoustic. And I know that You've said it before on stage with acoustic guitars that acoustic is not necessarily your bag, but it's becoming your bag more and more as you play more live on acoustic and you play more in the studio. And Heavy Load certainly speaks to that aptitude now on the acoustic, right?
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because when I'm sitting around the house, I play more acoustic than anything.
Right.
I just don't think of it as a performance instrument for me because I've spent all my life performing on electric guitar. I write more on acoustic than I do on electric. And I love the whole idea of accompanying myself on acoustic guitar. But there are so many people that are great at it that I never thought of myself as one of those people. And I do feel like I'm getting better at it because I do it more and more. But it's such a big part of the blues that side had to be represented on this record, even though oddly enough, the only two acoustic songs are original songs and not old blues covers.
Right. The other one is If Heartaches Were Nickels, right? That's the other.
No,
The
song Black Horizon.
Oh,
which is the song that ends the album. It comes right after the, if you have it in sequence, it comes right after the Howlin' Wolf.
Yes.
I Asked Her for Water. And then kind of segues into another acoustic song called Black Horizon.
Okay, my notes are a little bit off here. That's okay. The Feel Like Breaking Up Somebody's Home, the Ann People song. Again, it's a Government Mule tune now, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, it used to be an Ann, but the way you guys do it, you make it your own and have always made it your own. It's funny how the lyrics in that song could go either way. I mean, it was originally written by men for Anne, and then Anne sang it. And so that makes sense. And now you sing it, but it's so much more of a Government Mule tune now than it was before. And I think that's because of the performance. It's either because of what Danny does or because of what you do. But talk a bit about that tune and making it your own, not necessarily making it sound like a cover.
We've played that song quite a few times through the years, and it has become, in our minds, a Government Mule song, or at least a Government Mule version or arrangement.
Right.
It's what happens when a band stays together and you continue to inch forward on an arrangement night after night after night. There will be certain nights that stand out, and then you go back to that and use that as the new template. And it changes. It changes every time we do it. That's why we're actually offering on the main CD, there's like a 6-minute version that fades out. But on the bonus CD, there's like a 9-minute version that continues jamming because the hardcore fans kind of need that. You know, it's a challenge when you get into the studio for Government Mule to not make every song a long song, but then you lose some of the balance. It's nice to have balance between the 4-minute songs and the 8-minute songs, you know?
Well, by my count,
I love that version.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, by my count, there are a couple of songs on the main record, not on the bonus disc, that do go for a while. And one of them is the next one that I'm going to ask you about is I Asked for Water, She Gave Me Gasoline is the Howlin' Wolf tune. And the original is only 255, I think, it clocks in at. And so your version's a little bit longer. And what's interesting is that I don't know if he's out of tune or if he's purposely playing. And you would know, I'm not a musician, so I can't say, but it sounds like it's out of tune or it's down tune or something on the original. And you take that as an opportunity to muddy it up so much more when you perform it because of the way the original is performed. I guess you just go with that feeling.
That's exactly right. That's a really good observation. The original version, and I just had this conversation with a friend of mine about this song yesterday. And the original version is so broken, so fractured sounding. It sounds like they're learning the song, but then they kept that as the recording. And that happened a lot in the 50s and early 60s when there was no budget. But it also adds this spookiness and this edge to it that makes it one step closer to rock and roll and that transition from blues to rock that Howlin' Wolf was such a huge part of. His voice and the angular nastiness that those tracks sounded like. So I was thinking, I don't want to do it like his version, but I want to capture a similar nasty, atonal sort of weirdness for our recording. So I thought, okay, well, and I started playing this kind of, it's almost got a Hendrix-y vibe in a weird sort of way, but the note choices are very odd and atonal. And that was to kind of pay tribute to how weird the original version was. I guess I got the idea to do that song years ago when James Blood Ulmer sat in with the Allman Brothers and did that song. And it was so broken sounding and beautiful that it stuck with me. So, being a huge Howlin' Wolf fan, it's a less obvious one to do.
Yeah.
Because not many people are attracted to how atonal that song really is.
It sounds like the beginnings of Smokestack Lightning, but Smokestack is more rehearsed and refined compared to that too. Like it has, I think, similar chord progression, and I could be totally wrong, but
that's exactly right. It's almost the same approach, but Smokestack is more refined and more they knew what they were doing.
Right. They just practiced I Asked for Water over and over again and said, nope, this is a different song when we get it right.
And I'm curious, was there a second take? I've always wondered that, because a lot of those records, if the vocal was good, they kept it.
Right.
And so Wolf's performance is magnificent. So maybe that was the story.
It's been crazy, this pandemic thing, and it's given you a chance to do so many different things. You've probably written a lot. You've had a chance to play just you and Danny live, which was, I got to tell you, just incredible. And what a treat for fans to hear those songs and the way that you two perform them. There's this rumor of a new record with a very special guest who you've brought on stage a couple of times. What's the last 2 years been like for Warren Haynes?
The whole world went through this same nightmare. And so for me, having been too young to experience going through like wartime, I was really young at the end of Vietnam, but that's the only thing I can compare when, like in a world war, the entire world is going through the same anxiety and the same uncertainty. And I feel like it was so unique to have that global problem where we're all getting up and confronting the same anxieties every day. Early on, I realized that writing is going to be my way out of this. That was my solace. That was my creative outlet and an opportunity for me to keep from going crazy. And I wrote more than I've written, at least in decades. And so that's kind of what led to this whole let's make two records thing. I don't know that I would ever want to do that again, but coming out of the lockdown and on the other side of an odd sort of creative spurt, I felt like it was the right thing to do. It was tough. I was at home with my family, which is both great and challenging at the same time. It was great. It was the most time I've ever spent with my son, who just turned 10. You know, we spent a year and a half together, which was fantastic, without me going, okay, I'll be back in a week. And there were great parts to it. There were terrible parts to it. I'm glad that we're inching towards some sort of normalcy, but still there's a lot of uncertainty still right now. And when you look at what's going on, not just in America, but in many, many countries around the world, but definitely going on in America too, where there's just so much unrest. I would like to think we would turn this into a way of remedying that, but so far we haven't.
Right. Right. The other thing that I found that you've done, and I don't know if it's because you've been closer to home and closer to your computer, but you've been a lot more prolific on social media in terms of when great icons pass. You've kind of become this beacon of history and this beacon of inspiration when Eddie Van Halen passed, and recently when Charlie passed, that you write these really long, informative, but also very personal messages about the passing of these icons. Is that something that you've noticed yourself, or is that just because of who these icons have been and thus you've needed to have an outlet for your thoughts on some of these matters?
Unfortunately, it's mostly because so many of our heroes are passing. And I've kind of, I don't want to say painted myself into a corner, but once you write about a few people that are equally heavy, then assuming I have something to say, I feel like I can't ignore doing the same for all these people that deserve that recognition. You know, in some cases, it could be someone obscure, like but maybe in our world. Like when I wrote about Dennis Edwards from The Temptations, he was one of my heroes growing up and one of my favorite singers, someone that I patterned my early singing style around. But the average Government Mule fan may not know who Dennis Edwards was. And I felt like it was important for me to speak out about how important he was, whether you knew it or not, because maybe he didn't influence someone, but he influenced what influenced them.
Right.
And so I like to connect the dots on stuff like that. And if I have a personal story, I like to share it. And unfortunately, there have been a lot of cases where there is a personal story involved.
Yeah. Yeah. What's next? This album drops not until November. So it's a bit of ways away. You're touring. You just wrapped up a little tour. And I know that touring right now is getting more and more difficult. And people are canceling tours or rerouting tours. What's next for Mule in terms of your plan moving forward?
Well, we just finished 5 weeks, and it was a very diligent COVID protocol tour. We would test every day. We'd pull into the venue. The bus would pull up to a testing station. We all get tested. Everybody's wearing masks backstage. No friends and family, only working personnel. And we all agreed, meaning band, crew, promoters, management, booking agent, everybody involved agrees that that's the way it has to be for now. It was successful in the way that so far nobody in our world has tested positive. But there's so many tours that are getting sidelined, you know. We're going to continue being diligent about it and monitoring the situation and hoping that it's getting better and better and that eventually we'll move indoors, do some stuff. Hopefully that will work out. And eventually we'll go overseas and hopefully that will work out. I would really like to think that we can promote this record and promote the next record in some sort of normal way. But we have to be pragmatic about it and realize that in an already uncertain music business, things are more uncertain than ever right now.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I wanted to mention, Dave Grohl was on Stern, I think this week or late last week. And he mentioned September 11th and he mentioned his mom going west on a bus. And he says his contention is that you and Mama Grohl are besties now, or were at the time. Can you tell me your, so his story goes that 9/11 happened. She was living, they lived, or at least Mama Grohl lived 8 miles from the Pentagon. And obviously Dave wanted to get her out of DC. And so they were looking for a tour bus. And the only tour bus they could find was the one that was moving Warren Haynes from the East Coast to the West Coast, and that it was just the two of you alone on that trip. Can you shed some light on that trip and what happened? Some, it's like a crazy 10-20 years later.
Well, there was three of us. It was Virginia Grohl and myself and Matt Bush, who was my tour manager at the time.
Oh, wow.
And so we had found a bus that would get me to my gig in Denver, because obviously I was living in New York City.
Yeah.
All the airports were going to remain closed. And we had found a bus that said, if I could get to Allentown, Pennsylvania, they would pick me up and get me to my gig on time. And we said, okay, book it. Let's do it. And so a few hours later, we got a call saying, hey, look, you can say no, but here's the situation. Dave Grohl, who I had just recently met at that time, and we'd become casual friends.
Yeah.
Called looking for a bus, and we told him the story, and would you be interested in his mom sharing the bus? And I said, yeah, that would be totally fine. The plan was, they would pick her up. The bus was coming from North Carolina, would pick her up in Northern Virginia outside of DC, come to Allentown, pick me up, drop me and Matt Bush in Denver, and continue on to California and drop her off. And I said, yeah, that would be fine. And apparently David called his mom and told her the situation. And she's like, oh, I don't know, is he nice? And he's like, yeah, he's nice. He'll be fine. You know, and we are, since then, she wrote a book talking about that experience and interviewed my mom. It's a book about rock and roll moms or music business moms. Right. And so now she and my mom are close. And, I just saw her recently when Dave came to Christmas Jam at the 30th anniversary. Virginia came with him, and we were able to reconnect. And she's a wonderful person, and it was such a surreal experience because no one was ready to listen to music or watch TV or watch movies or anything at that time. So all we did was talk or remain silent for the entire trip, which was like 36 hours.
Right.
Now, looking back, the humorous part of the whole thing, which was definitely not humorous at the time, you know, my apartment was in the quarantine zone of New York City, which meant I had to put all my luggage into a laundry cart or a shopping cart type thing and push it 14 blocks to get out of the quarantine zone to catch a cab that didn't want to take me to Coney Island, where two friends of mine were waiting to take to drive me to Allentown.
Wow.
It was the most crazy experience. So getting there was just like this huge ordeal, you know, but that's permanently embedded in all of our heads. You know, we all became really close over that, the period of that 36-hour bus ride. And literally, the driver only stopped one time other than fueling. He stopped one time to rest for about 4 hours. We went and got our only meal of the trip. And these days, you couldn't even do that. Regulations wouldn't even allow you to do that. But that was the only way we were going to make our gig in time, was to do it this way or cancel.
Right.
So what a crazy story.
What a crazy story. I love the record. I love the bonus disc as well. We haven't even touched the bonus disc. Let's talk a bit just quickly about the premise of the bonus disc. You mentioned it earlier. You wanted to give hardcore fans a little more of what's going on this project and longer versions. There's Good Morning Little Schoolgirl. There's a longer version of Feel Like Breaking Up. Feel Like Breaking Up Somebody's Home. What's the deal with the bonus record?
We had several songs. You know, we're a long-winded band, and our audience loves XS as well. So we wanted to include, there's five additional songs that weren't on the main CD. One original song called Hiding Place, and four other covers. And then there's that extended version of Feel Like Breaking Up Somebody's Home. And then there's two live tracks, a live version of, as you mentioned, Good Morning Little Schoolgirl, and a live version of the Little Willie John song, Need Your Love So Bad, that Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac had a hit with back in the 60s. And there, it'll also be available on vinyl that way. So, you know, in this day and age, we just always like to offer the fans the option. And what we've found is that a much higher percentage of Government Mule fans buy the deluxe version than buy the standard version. Because I guess our fans are like we are. We want to have all the stuff.
Yeah. You know, we didn't mention it, but we should, because you mentioned Good Morning Little Schoolgirl, or we both did, but Hook Herrera plays on this record as well. And then Jenny Hill and Buford O'Sullivan also play on this record. And we didn't mention the horn. Didn't mention the horn section and Hook as well. Again, those were just people that you added, obviously, after the recording, right?
Yeah, the horn section came out to New England, came out to the studio to record with us, and we recorded two of the blues songs with them. So we recorded the horns in the little blues room, and they also recorded on two of the songs for the upcoming Mule record, which we recorded in the big room. So one of those blues songs is track two on the main record, which is called Hole in My Soul.
Yes.
And then track two, I think, on the bonus record is the old Willie Dixon song that Otis Rush did called You Know My Love, which is one of my favorites. I really wanted that song to be on the main CD, but in the long run, just for pacing and balance purposes, it wound up being on the bonus one.
This sounds like a big tease for a Government Mule record, for an original Government Mule record. We're going to have to wait till the new year, I guess, for the new.
sometime next year. And I'm so happy with the material and the performances and the recording for that record as well. I'm really excited about it. It's hard kind of sitting on it, but the saving grace is that we have this blues record now that we're focusing on and starting to play some of the blues stuff live, which is really, really fun.
Yeah. Warren, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Thank you again for spending the time and for making amazing music that we all love. And I really want to see you guys live soon again. So hopefully we will.
Absolutely. Good to see you.
For more on Government Mule, including tour details and your chance to pre-order Heavy Load Blues, visit mule.net. Before we leave you, let's listen to another track off of Heavy Load Blues. Here is the Tom Waits original, Make It Rain.
You've been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. For more, visit thesoundpodcast.com.